Welcome back, everybody, to another installment of Two Legs. We are a Paul McCartney podcast where we mainly feature discussion on the solo work of Paul McCartney. Joining me today is my partner in crime, my co-host, Tom Hunyadi. You might recognize him from his other show that he does, Talk More Talk, a solo Beatles video cast with Joe Mayo, Ken Michaels, and Kid O'Toole. Tom, how are you, my friend?
I'm doing wonderful, buddy. Another kick-ass topic. I can't wait to discuss. And,
different kind of show, different take, and a unique guest. And for episode 176 today, we have in the OG fan, my dad, John Nichols, here to talk about Ram, McCartney collecting, and really what it was like to experience and listen to McCartney in real time when this stuff came out. Mainly Ram, because it was really kind of just, it was not really well received critically when it first came out. And many people who bought that album at the time really felt otherwise. And I'm proud to say my dad was one of those people. And we're going to talk to him today about McCartney and Ram in particular, but really kind of his collecting and kind of his entering the Beatles world and being a first generation Beatle fan, as he's proudly been his whole life and passed down to me. So welcome to the show, Dad.
Thank you. Thank you for having me on.
Yeah, nice to meet you, and looking forward to hearing your story. You know, Andy, you know, Ram, I mean, it was so criticized, you know, by the critics, you know, then in 71, and in his, I mean, they were just beating him up. I mean, he was taking the blunt of the blame, right, for the Beatles breaking up. And but the cool thing was, is the what, you know, the bad reviews that he was getting, it didn't really necessarily show in sales. And I mean, and how his albums and singles did in the charts. I mean, except for maybe Wildlife there. But then for most of his career, in the especially in the 70s, you know, chart wise, you know, there wasn't too many that were better than him.
Right. Critics be damned. Commercially, right. He was still, I think that's an example of showing how the buying public really just says, well, screw what they wrote. We're going to buy it anyway because we like it.
Right.
So, you know, true. And, mm-hmm. you know,
so yeah, I hear you.
So Dad, just tell us a little bit about your kind of entry into, but we'll take it back into, you know, Beatle days and then work our way up into the McCartney and Ram and stuff like that and Wings, but talk about your initial kind of introduction to music, the Beatles as a whole, and buying albums and collecting them as they came out, when they came out in the 60s.
Yeah. Our house was always, there was music always going in the house. My mom listened to a contemporary radio station for those days in the 50s. They played American standard, pop standard stuff. And my dad was a pub singer and liked the crooners. And we had a lot of that stuff on our record players.
Did you have one of those big console like record players? You know, yeah. What I'm talking about, with the big speakers on the sides?
Yep. It didn't have a TV in it, but it was about 6 feet long.
Wow. Yeah. I remember those were cool.
Like a piece of furniture for the living room.
Yeah, exactly.
It was probably the biggest thing in the house.
So let's talk about some early memories there with the musical kind of, and you know, and things that you heard, remember.
I'm apologizing because of course the lawnmower guys are here.
Oh, well, of course.
Picking that up.
No, right. A little bit, but it's not bad. We can hear you and that's fine.
Yeah, so I liked my parents' music. You know, I didn't cringe from it. But when I started to hear Buddy Holly and the Everly Brothers singing, and that spoke out to me a little bit more. That I felt that they were speaking to my age group.
Okay. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Pre-Beatles, that's who, you know, I was into, you know, to as much as an 8-year-old kid can be, you know, but right. That's who I like. But once the Beatles came on the radar screen, New York radio was gaga over them. They they promoted all their songs, and probably I think Ed Sullivan had a lot to do with that because his roots are in radio, mm-hmm. and he probably had a lot of connections. Having seen them in England, he probably let them know that these guys are going to be big.
Right. Do you remember how much in advance? I mean, Beatles were in February of 64. Do you remember how much in advance prior to that you got the radio stations pushing the Beatles?
Well, I would say probably 6 months prior, but I think after the Kennedy assassination, it really, really picked up steam.
So November of 63.
Yeah.
Yeah, because they were already, come December, they were already scheduled to come here anyway. So that capital really mm-hmm. started to get behind that machine of the Beatles are coming and building yeah. that hype. And I think that hysteria is between November and December of 63 carries over into the early 64 and obviously their arrival, which I'm sure, you saw on TV, right, Dad?
Oh, yeah. I was there. Hands, hands on chin. About 6 inches from the screen.
Wow. So what was that experience like? I mean, you knew that was coming, right? I mean, was this like one of those things where, I mean, just time just stands still and everybody is in, it just seems like everybody we talked to that lived it, time just stood still and everybody on the planet was just living, or in the USA anyways, was just watching and experiencing this group from Liverpool.
Yeah, well, we kind of knew the songs by then. I Want to Hold Your Hand. I think Please Please Me. A couple of their early hits, Love Me Do. And right. So it was got a charge out of seeing them perform those songs. That was a big charge for me. To finally see them was
in the flesh. Yeah, on TV. Right. It was after all that and. Much to the chagrin of the elders, right?
Well, my mom kind of liked them. She just had a problem with the hair.
The long hair, right? And wasn't really that long to be. I mean, to be honest, it wasn't really that long.
Well, but when you think about
it, was.
Well, right, because in the 1950s, everybody's got crew cuts, right? So, yeah.
You either had a crew cut or you had it all slicked back.
Mm-hmm.
And, what they used to call a DA, short right. for yes.
Right. 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 So in 64, you're 10 or 11 years old and you're obviously into them and enjoying them, but you're not yet really buying records and collecting albums yet at that point. Right.
No, that's a few years away. Yet.
Yeah. The then throughout the 60s, I mean, are you continuing to grow into a major Beatles fan as their music is coming out year by year? Or are you also following other musical acts as well?
Well, the Beach Boys, were big, in my circle of friends and all too. And another moment with the Beatles that kind of cemented me with them was the movie Hard Day's Night and the song Hard Day's Night. The opening to Hard Day's Night was, it just grabbed you by the shirt.
Right.
And the last chord cinched it for me, when George goes on that little riff at the end of the song, I said, these are my guys.
That's very cool.
But now, did you see that movie in the theaters, Dad, or no?
I don't think I saw that in the theaters. I saw Help in the theaters a few times.
Okay.
But Hard Day's Night, I might have saw it the second time I saw Help. There might have been a double
feature.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
But not when it was initially out.
Yeah.
Although right. I've been to the movies a couple of times, but by myself, but not for that one.
Yeah. getting into the later years, 67, 68, I mean, were you still as excited for Beatle releases? I mean, we talked about a couple people where in 67, as the music and the lyrics get a little more sophisticated, people took a what they call a Beatles break and then maybe, went off to the Beach Boys or the Monkees or whatever like that. Talk about that era, 67, 68, and 69 for you as a fan.
we had, and I had such anticipation for when they were going to release a new album. Mm-hmm. It was palpable, you know, whenever it was coming. And I know now, with Andy's tutelage, that the American releases and the British releases were entirely different. Right. I didn't know then. I was just, oh no, there's a new album coming out. I can't wait to hear right. it. You know, I wasn't buying albums yet, but just on pins and needles, waiting for the next one to come out. And I had like friends. My ended up being my future brother-in-law. We were simpatico when it came to the Beatles, and we would just discuss it like we're doing now.
Mm-hmm. Well, one of the best analogies I can remember you telling me was that I can remember was when Free as a Bird came out, and I remember being so excited about that, and you were like, see this excitement? This is how it was for every right. time a new single or an album came out. And that's true, right?
Yes. Yeah. I mean, you know, that was the best way I can explain it to you. I could see it in, you know, in your eyes and how you were anticipating everything.
Right.
And it just brought me back.
Right. But going on to like when the music kind of changed a little bit, like Tom was saying, by the time Sgt. Pepper rolls around, now you're starting to buy albums, right?
I was getting them more as gifts, you know.
Okay.
I was working, you know, like as a stock boy, you know, in a grocery store and doing that kind mm-hmm. of stuff. But I didn't really have the money to spend on an album, even though they were only about $3 or $4. But that right. was, you know, more money for me at the time. But I started to listen to The Who, not so mm-hmm. much the Stones. I like some of the Stones songs, but a whole album from them really didn't do it for me. But The Who were up there, and I, you know, trying to think of some other songs. And I, you know, a little later on, the prog stuff started coming out, and
right.
I was a big Yes fan. I'm a big
you don't
Yes.
say. Anyways, but if you could, you know. It's like 67, 68. I mean, describe the four. I mean, how did you feel about the fours as individuals? I mean, well, who was your favorite at the time? Who's you know, music did you
gravitate?
Were you more gravitated towards, you know, at that time? You know, talk about the four individuals and what your guys' perception of them was at that time.
Well, you know, at that time, we were mainly focused on John and Paul. Mostly John, I would say. He was the perceived leader of the group at that time.
Right.
And he was so witty. Whenever he would yeah. be interviewed or something, it was kind of like must listen to when he was on the air, you know. And
it was almost like shock radio at the time, you know, for them, because like you said, you're it's almost like, what is he going to say next? You know,
that's yeah. The whole we're, you know, yeah. we're better than God or we're greater.
Yeah.
Than,
oh yeah.
That whole
yeah.
controversy. People, yeah. You know, the people overreacted to mm-hmm. big time. That was there. You know, I kind of read through what he was trying to say, and it didn't bother me at all.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I thought the only time I really thought of Paul as an individual was when he did Michelle and he was alone on stage. I think it was probably Shindig or Hullabaloo, one of those shows. And I'm like,
right.
this isn't good. The other guys aren't out there with him. What's with this? I don't like this.
Right, right. Yeah, when he would get his solo spot for Michelle yeah. or Yesterday during one of those shows. Yeah.
Yeah.
And to me, George and Ringo were still in the background, and I loved their bits in the movies that they were in, you know, and thought they had a really good stage presence and everything. But it was mostly John and Paul, and I just liked the ebb and flow of, you know, going into like Rubber Soul and
right,
you know, and then the more psychedelic stuff. Which is, that's where they lost my mom.
Okay. Yeah. See, that's what I'm always interested in hearing is like when people, they say they take that Beatle break, you know, what part of their career was it that they finally said, okay, well, I'm just going to, you know, move on to something else now.
Well, I moved on to other things, but I wouldn't call it a Beatle break. I would call it the Beatles opening doors to me.
Yeah. Okay. I like that. Yeah.
You know, probably the next band I focused on more, you know, more than them was Steely Dan.
Okay.
And they just kind of like did a similar thing to me with the Beatles and grabbed me and said, you got to listen.
Yeah. Right. Right. Were you also looking for literature on the Beatles as well? Were you reading up on them or were you just listening to the music?
Mostly the music. I would listen to back then FM radio was a really great resource, especially at night. You know, they would talk at length about subjects like music and the musicians, and they would sometimes have them on, which was great, especially NEW FM. John was on there quite a bit. And the reading material then was kind of teen type stuff, you know, heartthrob type things that I never really bought.
No, right. And Rolling Stone launches in 67 or 68, right, 67. So, you know, journalism is still very, rock journalism is in this country is still very new and up and coming, but kind of leads us on to where we're going with the conversation with Paul later on.
Right.
But talk a little bit about, okay, 1970, the Beatles break up, shattered, right?
Oh, yeah. You know, we used to have a newspaper in New York, well, it's still around, called the New York Post. They used to come out with an afternoon edition, and that was the first I saw that, you know.
Right.
I mean, we would hear snippets about how they were having contractual things going on. And then I saw a 4-inch banner headline on the afternoon paper saying that they split, Beatles split. I think that's what the headline said, but that was, right. You know, I love that memory will always stick with me.
Uh-huh. Did you get the sense or was there much literature out there that said it was Paul that broke up the Beatles? Because, you know, you see that famous, you know, headline in the UK, you know, Paul quits the Beatles. I'm kind of curious if we got that here in the States as well.
I think we were in the Yoko broke up the Beatles camp.
Okay.
You know, people that I associated with.
Right. And they're not able to accept her in the Beatles community. You know, I think there's a lot of people that still can't, you know, accept the fact that, you know, John would fall in love with her, I think.
Yeah. Which is, it was sad on our part. He's totally, you know, has every right to fall in love with who he wants to fall in love with. And we had no business feeling the way we did.
Right. By this time, you know, were you getting records, 1970, 71? I mean, are you, the Beatles are breaking up. They're starting to release solo records or solo 45s. Did these interest you at the time as well?
Yeah, they did. We were, and it was a big feeling at the time that they would possibly get back together at some point.
Mm-hmm.
So... Our thinking was, my own thinking was, how would this sound if they were all doing it? Man, if this was a Beatle album, it, you know,
yeah,
be off the charts.
Right.
And it kind of did, almost did that until it was no longer a possibility.
Yeah.
Yeah. Let's just start with, you know, your thoughts on some of the early, you know, some of the solo records or, you know, before Ram, like All Things Must Pass. You know, what were your thoughts on that?
I thought it blew me away. It was great. You know, it just showed, you know, what a hidden talent George really was, you know, and kind of a, you know, the movie Let It Be had been out and it kind of touched on some of the, not as good as the Jackson remake of it, but
right.
It kind of, touched on what George could have contributed, you know, had he had a little bit more support.
Yeah, I agree with you there. I'm still blown away by the fact of what Paul said in the one of the 69 meetings. George is there, John and Paul. Ringo's, I think, in the hospital at the time, and they're talking about the next album. And then everybody, John, Paul, and George getting 4 tracks each, I think it was. And then Paul just comes out and says, "Well, I didn't think, up until Abbey Road, I didn't think George's stuff was up to snuff, I mean," and he's sitting right there. So it's pretty amazing. And then here we are, we marvel at stuff like, While My Guitar Gently Weeps, Within You, Without You, Taxman, stuff like that. And then here he is, he thinks so much less of his music. It's still kind of mind-boggling.
I think what turned off a lot of them towards George is
the Indian music.
Ability was his connection to the Indian and the Eastern raga type music, and I think they would really did a split over that, because George just was into that whole philosophy, and they were not.
Was that something you would skip over? On albums like Revolver and Sgt. Pepper, would you not want to play those Indian style music yourself? Sitar?
I liked it. I didn't care for the what I would consider some filler pieces like Number 9.
Yeah, Revolution 9.
Yeah. my buddies went to the Bangladesh concert. I was working or something. I couldn't go, to my lifelong regret.
Well, but you also had a chance encounter with a certain someone on a street you said hello to about a year or so later. Why don't you tell that story?
We were constantly in the village. We were,
a 10
or 15 minute train ride away from the city, and we'd hit all the different spots down there, record stores and stores selling other stuff, and that John and Yoko were being crowded in on a corner somewhere downtown. I forget exactly where. And he had so many people around him. I said, he doesn't need us. But I was with about 3 or 4 guys. So,
Well,
there he is. You're seeing him. He's actually alive in the flesh.
Right. It's funny, you say that because, me being, as a tour caterer, I got to, see a lot of, musicians up close. And then you're thinking to yourself, should I go up and say hi to them? I've been fortunate enough to be in that position where I would be able to interact, with them. But like you said, your conscience kind of kicks in a little bit. You see a lot of people around them, he doesn't need another person, coming in up to him. But then again, some people are fearless like that. There's like, oh, there's John Lennon. Let's go say hi.
Yeah. Yeah. I felt we'd be intruding.
Right. No. And I get that. I get and respect that, but the solo, let's get into Paul here. The solo stuff. Especially let's start off with the first solo record, McCartney. And I'm kind of curious about your take on that, because here's someone that just coming off the heels of Abbey Road, and then, Let It Be and Long and Winding Road, such great polished, finished, songs. And here you get this McCartney record, which really doesn't reflect that in a way, if you know what I'm saying.
Yeah. I think I'm aware that I believe he played every instrument on the album.
Right.
Mm-hmm. So, I mean, you can hear that after, if you listen for it, it did need some polishing up. But the bass was there, the basic good songs and the body of work is good.
Yeah.
But it clearly showed that he wasn't really cutting it on his own yet.
Right.
Yeah. But the talent you saw, Every Night and Maybe I'm Amazed and Junk and, it was there. But I think a lot of people get, were expecting, like Tom said, the hugeness of like Abbey Road type production and to have a very homespun affair of a record. is a letdown. And I don't think people really understood where he was going with it.
Yeah. Maybe if they were a little bit more open about what the production level was, people would have maybe understood.
And then the breakup factor, you know, the breakup factor that Paul was really, you know, the nemesis that the media painted as the villain who broke up the Beatles. So albums like McCartney and Ram, which we'll get to, are not really fairly being reviewed by these people, but the buying public knows better, and you were one of them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. And that brings me to, you know, Andy, you just said it being, you know, reviews. Were you a person that read reviews prior to buying the record, or did you wait until after you listened? You know, did you pay attention to reviews?
I did not pay attention to reviews. I might have picked up a copy of it, a secondhand copy of it, when I heard that they were talking about an album that I had purchased, you know. But I kind of knew where the Rolling Stone guys were. You know, they had a love affair with John Lennon. So, you know, that's the way it was going to be.
Right. Well, what about you too? I mean, were you still a Lennon fan at this point in time? You know, the first true Lennon record, Plastic Ono Band?
No.
I kind of went other ways. Me and John kind of went our separate ways a little bit.
Right, because I can see, like, I remember just growing up looking through your albums, you had the McCartney albums. You had McCartney, Ram, Wildlife, Red Rose Speedway, Band on the Run, Venus and Mars. You had all those albums. You didn't really have a whole lot of John. You know, you had Chey Fish, The Greatest Hits. So you kind of went more, you said when the Beatles were together, John was like the guy that you might have gravitated towards. But solo-wise, you kind of went more in a Paul direction, which is interesting.
I think my philosophy changed towards life a little bit, you know, and what he was proselytizing in his songs didn't always connect with the way I was feeling at the time.
Right, right.
Without naming any songs, you know.
Right. Maybe alienating a fan base, you know, some part of his fan base
with some of those songs. Very small portion of that, but I would say yes.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Very interesting, because that's I remember, but it's so funny that you say that, because so many people, well, and you and me, like, we love and Tom, you too, you love the John Beatles material. And well, listen, we love the solo stuff too, but a certain fan base might have been gravitated towards Paul based on what John was doing. Because John's solo work is not everybody's cup of tea. It's just it's not. So it's Paul's is a little more accessible. You want to call it lightweight, like Rolling, like these critics did. Fine. You want to call it sugar, you know, like kind of like an album like Ram that, you know, that we're going to get to. I mean, you know, obviously the buying public knew better, Dad.
I had a little bit of a reconnect when he did the rock and roll album.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought that was some of the best stuff that he did.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Yeah. I find that fascinating too, because I tend to find that record to be a little uneven, you know, especially in production. I wish it was, I mean, it's raw. Yeah. But I think it could even be a little bit more raw. You know, I think it could be even a little bit more stripped, you know what I mean? In a record, but it's fine. But yeah, I mean, I get it, because, you know, listening to the Beatles, I generally gravitate towards John too. I mean, I like that rebellious, you know, part of John. I like that, you know, wittiness part of John, like we talked about. You know, and that doesn't mean I don't love Paul's stuff. Yeah, I love Paul's stuff too, but it just seems like John just was able to grab our attentions more with this stuff in the Beatles. I think when it comes solo, I mean, the stuff like, you know, The Power to the People, Give Peace a Chance. I mean, I think it's all well, good-hearted, well-attended stuff. But again, it's something you have to be in a certain mood for to listen to.
I view that as the precursor to Shut Up and Sing.
Right. I hear you. All right, so let's move on to Ram then, because here we go. Here's the, you know, the famous Rolling Stone review about this. And Andy, you talked about how it first received a favorable review first, right? And then the person was told to change the review. Was it, you know what I mean?
Oh, no, who was talking? No, that was who was telling us that a few weeks back? That, I know it wasn't from me, but they basically said it was what they did praise it. And they said, no, you can't do that. You got to, you know, because they were a John, they were a John favor, you know, heavy publication. So they were like, oh, no, you got to change that. I think that was for the McCartney review. I think Larry Graves was telling us that last
week. Yeah, that's right. That's right.
That they had to change it. But I think Ram is another case. You know, the album comes out, the original review, John Landau says that Ram is the nadir of of rock music. And, you know, now, I mean, first of all, like, you're not saying that if you don't have a bias, okay? You clearly, you have a bias to say that, because the album was received well by fans, of which we're talking to one today.
Number two in the States.
And here's his original copy, all from 1971, all beat up, still right here. Okay. So, I mean, he obviously didn't read that. Another bit, it went to number two. Uncle Albert is a huge hit. Number one.
Right.
So, I mean, I'm sure that song was all over the radio, Dad, wasn't it?
Yes, it was.
So?
Yep. Probably the main one from that album. I don't think they played much else, as you know.
Okay.
Except for the late night guys.
Right.
Ram is so incredibly inquisitional and so monumentally irrelevant, you can't even do that with it. It's difficult to concentrate on, let alone dislike or even hate.
That's the original review.
I mean, that's the first paragraph. I mean, obviously he's talking about Self-Portrait, you know, prior to that last sentence that I just read. But you know, just, yeah, it's so, you know, you can be mean, you can dislike something, but it just sounds like he's just like purposely being mean, you know, during this review. You know, he says that I think he eat at home, and he calls it the backseat, or sitting in the backseat of my car. He calls it. He doesn't even know the correct title to the
clown.
To the album. Yeah. So he says those are the two best songs on the album. He says this of Three Legs. They do strange and pointless things to the sound of his voice to liven it up. Uncle Albert sounds like the worst piece of light music Paul has ever done. Monkberry Moon Delight is the bore to end all bores. And he calls Heart of the Country the lowest point on the album. So yeah, pretty tough. You know, and the reviews online, you can read it, and you know, and he talks about you know, stuff, you know, his Beatles stuff, and you know, how John was there to be, you know, the person to control Paul's Muzak, you know, as he said so much in the How Do You Sleep song. But go ahead.
I think Paul has had a song with John on that album.
Right.
Yeah. Well that's too many people. That's
too many people.
Too many people. Too many people. Yeah.
Right. But you didn't know that at the time, though, right?
Or did you? Or did you know? Did you? Or did you have a feeling then when you knew that was about John, or no?
It sounded very personal to me, you know, and I knew how tight they were, and you know, the rancor from the breakup and everything else. I thought at the time that it could have been directed at him.
Mm-hmm. Right, but it's so well known now. But in 1971, it's all coded messages and lyrics. So you're guessing. Like, it's so easy to say now.
You gotta read the lyrics.
Right.
Well, you couldn't read the lyrics.
Oh, you couldn't then.
Right, but you couldn't, because there was no lyrics included with it, you see?
Right.
Yeah. But you listen, and then you play it again, and you play it. Yeah. That's why you're going to have a lot of skips if you go to play that record.
Right.
Oh, I'm sure there's quite a few.
You're going to ruin a needle or two.
The the line, too many people preaching practices. Did you pick up on that being the part that was written about John, or did you discover that later on?
I always felt it was directed mainly at, it was like a breakup kind of emotional packed album with a lot of references to that in that song.
Right. You took your lucky break and broken.
Might have been more towards George.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Could have been. But let's just talk about the album as a whole. Right. I mean, musically, like I think you can still think it's probably one of his best records, right? You felt then and now, right? Still?
Yeah, there were some that, I'm not going to jump up and down about. But overall, I really like the album.
You know, okay. Which I Dear left Boy. Downstairs. That's okay.
It also has John notes in it, I think.
No, see, that's another one you thought initially it could be about John, but it's actually not about right. John. It's about Linda's ex-husband. But John thought it was about him,
mm-hmm.
okay. which he did. He did, but...
I'm not about it like you are, but that's how I felt at the time.
Right.
Well, again, yeah, because you're hearing these lyrics, you don't get to read the lyrics, but you're hearing it, and then, I mean, that's all you can do is just speculate that it could be about John at that time, because it does sound so close to their relationship.
Yeah, it does. It absolutely sounds like it could have been, they could have been talking about each other.
And even Three Legs, I've always been under the impersonation, the assumption that, Three Legs is meaning the other three Beatles, that's how I thought too. So,
right.
But yeah, I mean, I can't, you know, you listen to it and you can kind of like.
I thought that
go
was.
Ahead. Go ahead, Dad.
What's that?
I was just going to say a hat tip to the blues.
Yeah.
Think so?
Right. Southern rock blues. Memphis blues.
Okay.
Right. The other thing about the record, too. The other thing about the record, too, is it's credited to Paul and Linda McCartney. Did you have any thoughts on that? When you first got the record?
Well, everybody knew that Linda was not a professional and that, Paul was
right.
sitting her in for whatever, his own reasons and trying to maybe make her into a star. That's we kind of overlooked her a little bit,
right.
Yeah. To be honest,
Yeah. What did you think of her contributions? Like,
not much.
Really? See, because for me, this album kind of sets the tone for what's to come. You know what I mean? In a way. I mean, one of the things that you think about when you think about Wings is those great backing vocals.
And the harmonies. Yeah.
I'm sure there were better backup singers available. Let me put it that way.
Fair enough.
Obviously Ram comes out and it does very well and it continues the record part, and you're buying albums a lot now at this point. I mean you bought Ram, you bought Wildlife, but you didn't like Wildlife though, right, Dad? You didn't enjoy it, right?
No, I was disappointed with Wildlife.
Yeah. I always felt like it was kind of a step back, kind of like in the same way McCartney for me felt like a little bit of a step back in a way. Here you got this great big production record, and then, now you go back to like, the homespun type feel again.
Yeah.
So I left the album downstairs, and can you talk about some of the other songs on it?
Yeah, so like Heart of the Country, Monkberry Moon Delight, Eat at Home, Long Haired Lady, The Backseat of My Car.
I like
I'm sure,
Long
you know.
Lady.
Yeah. Okay.
Backseat of My Car.
Yeah, good I mean, one. That was my number one when we counted down our top 101 McCartney songs. That was my number one.
Yeah.
Was The Backseat of My Car.
Great song. Great song. Yeah,
that was my number one.
Not Big Barn Bed.
No, not Big Barn Bed. No. If you had to pick a favorite, you know, a favorite track on the whole album, what song are you gonna pick?
Maybe Longhead Lady.
Wow.
You know, it's got a lot of nice, the melody to it is really nice. Backseat right. of My Car.
Yeah. It's funny though that you pick.
Go ahead, Tom. Go ahead.
I'm just saying it's funny that he picks Longhair Lady because that's filled with Linda's, you know, backing vocals on it.
True.
Yeah. It's a lot of give and take on it.
Yeah.
You mean your favorite's not?
I kind of block her out and I listen to Paul more.
Right. Well, you tell me. You mean you don't like "Smile Away"? Is your "Smile Away" is that your favorite song on the album?
Well, you know, I can't talk about it without talking about my brother Ed.
No. No, we can't.
We used to tease him with that song all the time.
Yeah.
Probably get the
speed a mile away.
Time and all that.
Plenty of airtime with that song. Woo! Yeah. I knew, just judging from your record collection, I knew what you had, and that's how I made my foray into the music, because you had it. So you had these albums, you know? That's how I was able to learn.
Truth be told, I never really forced any kind of music on Andy at all. He actually was more of a Chicago guy. Peter Cetera in particular.
Oh yeah.
When he first started listening to music. The main thing was there. All my albums were there, so, and now they're up there. But that's okay.
Well, I was gonna bring that up too, you know. Kind of passing the music down to the next generation. You said you really never, you know, forced this music, you know, out onto any of your kids, then, I would imagine, right?
No. I mean, you know, probably when they were teens and, you know, and older, growing up, I had very little Beatles stuff on the air playing in our house at the time. Right. And we get some, not as much as, you know, when it was just me and my wife Fran, or, you know, Andy was little. Kind of, it grew. We'll put it that way.
Right.
My son Tom picked up on "Back to the Irish." What was the other one? I can't remember the name of the other song.
Luck of the Irish.
The Luck of the Irish. He would just start singing it on his own. Probably about 7 or 8.
Right. That's hilarious.
Well, I'll take a small credit for that, because, you know, I'll take a small credit for that, because they were kind of brainwashed into all this music and they didn't really have a choice. I did that to them, but he didn't do that to me.
Okay.
But they also could sing. They could also sing "Boris the Spider."
Yeah.
I see as get as low as possible.
Oh yeah, good memories with that one.
Yeah. Before we talk about seeing Paul live, talk about a little bit about, you know, 80s on and with Paul. Were you still following Paul into the 80s and later decades? And if not, tell us just why you just didn't feel like continuing to follow Paul.
I kind of went in another direction with Paul. Mainly I felt that he was a little repetitious. Okay. And you know, not to say that there wouldn't be a couple of songs on each of his albums that I would like, but it didn't move me enough to go run it out and get the album.
Plus you had kids to worry about.
Well, that, you know,
that didn't mean I stopped listening to music.
Yeah, exactly. You know, I mean, there's always a way to continue to listen to your favorite musician with kids or without kids, you know. So
sure.
You know, I mean, yeah, so if you didn't eat dinner one night, who cares? You know, what cares? I got the new McCartney record.
That's it, man. That's all I cared about.
You know,
I just my taste changed. I wouldn't say, you know, he you know, the quality of his music stayed the same, and, you know, but my musical likes went other ways.
Mm-hmm. Gotcha. So you weren't one of those people that would say, well, Paul hasn't done anything good since, you know, the Wings days, or he hasn't done anything good since, you know, Tug of War. I mean, you wouldn't be one of those people, you know what I'm saying? Because a lot of people, you'll see some older fans that will say, you know, Paul hadn't done anything good since this particular record. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I'm not one for being negative. You know, I mean, he's out there. People are buying it. They like it. You know, right. It's just not my cup of tea, you know, at this time, you know. Pipes of Peace, right. Things like that, you know, London Town. Yeah. Some of those were really, really good records. And okay. I'm not going to knock them.
Right. Fair enough. 76 tour, I hear you got to go to a show.
Yeah, I was in Great Lakes Naval Station at the time. And and they would post tickets and shows up in the different places on the base. Mm-hmm. And me and a couple of guys grabbed them and went down into Chicago. I think it was the Cow Palace or something. I'm not really sure of the name. Something like something to do with cows or bulls or something.
Was it indoor or outdoor, Dad? Indoor?
Indoor. Yeah. I would imagine it had to have been a pretty magical night.
Oh yeah. Yeah, definitely. I mean,
you're familiar with a lot of the songs, I would imagine too.
Yeah, I know them with the first few chords when they start going. I know what's coming on and all. You right. know, if I could I couldn't tell you the whole set list. but it was enjoyable.
Were you excited when he would play Beatles songs? Because I mean, this was the first time he started to, celebrate, you know, his past.
I think he did. I think he finished with one or two. I don't know.
Well, he did a couple. No, he did in the 76 tour. He did in the middle of the show. He did five Beatles songs. He did Yesterday, Blackbird, Long and Winding Road, and I've Just Seen a Face. So you got to see those. So, I mean, but it was a big deal then, because he hadn't really played any Beatles songs. So, but I mean, most of his set really centered around the Wings material, which by that time you were really obviously very familiar with, having bought Venus and Mars, and you knew Speed of Sound, you knew Band on the Run, and that became the act. It was Wings was the act at that point, which you knew.
Yeah, and I remember him. He was be questioned a lot about, hey, how come you're not playing any Beatles stuff? And he was really trying to promote Wings, and then he says, I'm in another band now. I got my other band's got a whole, you know, got these songs. I want to sing them. And I understand the desire to hear the old stuff, but I understood him wanting to do the new ones too.
But were you there going, man, I wish I heard Hey Jude, or were you happy that you were hearing the Wings material?
I was happy with whatever they decided to play. Are you kidding? who are you in the audience saying? I'm not there with a lighter saying, Freebird.
Right.
No, I don't do that.
Did you have an opportunity to see George in the 74 tour?
No.
Okay.
Yeah, just
that, you know, yeah. I would love to hear people's stories about that one, just because of, you know, again, his voice and, you know, him changing the lyrics to some of the songs.
He was a little rough then, I think.
Yeah.
That was not a very well received.
That was a rough fit.
Yeah, that was not a good tour for him. You know,
I had those days. I had seen the Allman Brothers, Jimi Hendrix, a couple of times.
You got to see Hendrix. Wow.
Yeah.
the ill-fated Monkees tour, or just on his own?
No, it was with Band of Gypsies. Buddy
All
Guy
right.
yep. and
Mitch Mitchell and on drums.
Actually, a New Year's Eve concert.
Mm. Wow!
And I was was that
at the Fillmore, Dad, or no?
Yes, it was.
With Fillmore East, yeah.
Wow.
Fillmore East.
Wow.
Wow.
And then he did a show on Randall's Island. and a lot of the people who were at Woodstock were at the show. That was an open air venue. And another 3-day music festival. I wasn't there for the 3 days. I was there for most of one day.
Let's dig into the Prague thing.
Even though what, Dad?
Yeah. I was going to say Randall's Island, although it's in the middle of the city, it's not the easiest place to get to.
No, it's not. No. Go ahead, Tom.
No, say, let's just jump into the Prague thing a little bit, because one, you know, my original co-host of the show, he was a big Prague guy. You know, Andy's a big Prague guy. I mean, obviously now you're a big Prague guy. I mean, what was the appeal of that music for you?
I thought it was innovative. My first draw was Emerson, Lake and Palmer, mm-hmm. who were, my memory might not be the best right now, but I'm not sure who was opening for who, but it was Emerson, Lake and Palmer, and Yes, in the was called the Palladium at the time, Lower Manhattan, okay. And I kind of think that Roundabout was a big song that was being played on the radio at the time, and I wanted to hear more of that type of music. And of course, you know, Carnival Number 9 and Brain Salad Surgery and all that from ELP. I might be jumping ahead a little bit, but.
All the same era, but to go from a Beatles pop world into Prague, it's
right.
A lot of people don't do that often, you know. So it's an interesting switch up.
Yeah, you know, I love the Beatles, and you know that what started me on my musical journey, so to speak. But it had many branches. You know, I mentioned Steely Dan. I mentioned Jimi Hendrix. I also was into the Doors and the Who.
Did
King Crimson?
That's what I was just going to say. So did Yes and ELP kind of like gravitate you then towards, like, you know, King Crimson, Genesis, Rush, you know, a little Jethro Tull as well.
Tull, right?
I mean, I didn't get a chance to see those guys play, but, you know, all of that music is kind of where I went. Following the Beatles breakup.
Wow. Well, it's definitely a big switch. I mean, it sounds like you're a huge fan of UK bands as well.
Yeah. Okay. I'll grant you that. You know, there's well, Andy's going to tell you that. You know, I'll listen to folk music. I'll listen to country music. You know, whatever is pleasing to my ear or it speaks to me in some way. You know,
right?
You know, I'm not gonna diss anything,
right?
The only thing about, I can't get into too much would be the heavy metal stuff, the headbanging stuff.
Understood. Understandable. Slowly trying to get. I know we talked about the '80s Chicago, and I was a big fan too. You know, being born in '73. You know, and you know, those great, you know, Chicago albums of those mid 80s with Pizza Terra, you know, was a big part of my life as well. But then, you know, I gravitated towards those first, you know, Terry Kath years of Chicago, and you know, trying to get, you know, Andy to listen to more, you know, or he has been listening to more of that. And for me, I mean, that's where it's at. Well, I mean that maybe a little just a slight touch of Prague in there, but more just, you know, the fusion of rock and jazz and so many other different styles of music, you know, with them, just really, you know, it's very relatable to me, you know, to the ear, my ear too.
Yeah, I think that's one of the reasons why you kind of get all these other genres, you know, within Prague. You get elements of classical. Like ELP, it does the what's the pictures at an exhibition, Dan, right? ELP, right?
Yeah.
So, you know,
if you look somewhere in your library, you'll see it there.
Oh yeah, it's there. It's there. Yeah. Didn't you see the Beach Boys and Chicago too? Did you see that tour or no?
Yes. Crosby, Stills and Nash, Beach Boys, Tom Scott, the LA Express. Jesse Colin Young without the Young Bloods, Joni Mitchell. That was at Freeport racetrack on Long Island. It had to be close to 300,000 people there.
Wow.
Back when, well, but back when there was like multiple, like in the concert you've talked about going to, like now we go to a concert, we go to see one act. Back then, when you in your concert going days, three or four artists would share the bill, and it was a whole big, it was a whole, it would go on all night, right? Like the concert, pretty much, Dad, like till all hours.
Yeah, it, you know, it was a whole day affair.
Yeah, I mean, they still do, you know, stuff like that. You know, they get like, you know, three or four
festivals, you know,
festival type shows. I mean, that's, they're doing it right now with what, Def Leppard, Motley Crue, you know, Joan Jett's on that tour as well.
Yeah.
So I mean, it still happens, but I mean, obviously the bands aren't as you know, not iconic. Yes,
not those not bands that you saw, man. These guys make a forgot to make a film about all the people you've seen. I wish they kept the ticket stubs.
Oh yeah, no kidding. Back when you didn't have to pay for back when you didn't have to pay $4,000 for a ticket like the you know, Boss and McCartney now, right?
No, but it's you know, I think it was a different time. Like you and I collect things differently now, and we're collectors. Right. I think my dad will tell you, like, you bought albums, you brought them to play and you brought them to parties. They weren't collectibles. You went to a concert, you didn't keep a stub. It wasn't such a collecting thing back then. You went to go, you bought an album because you liked it, you shared it, you, whatever. You went to a concert and that was it. It wasn't this whole big thing that it's turned into now, right, Dad? Pretty much.
Yeah, I mean, you might be the only one with that album. Then your friend whose house you were going to, hey, could you bring that McCartney album, or could you bring that Doors album, you know, whatever. And it would go, and you leave it there for a week or two. Go,
you see so many people writing their names on the records back then. You know.
Yeah, so I think his name's on it right here too.
There it is.
His name's on it. See,
that's great.
Yours.
Ed's name.
Yours.
Okay.
Oh yeah, not going, Ed's. Uncle Ed's name's not on there, is it?
No, this is yours. This is yours. This is your copy. See, there's no spine even. See how beat up this is, Tom?
Oh wow. Yeah. Damn. That was definitely well played.
This
traveled and well played.
Yes. Multiple moves over in 50 years.
Well, this was great. Thank you very much, John, for talking about your experience. Anything else
I appreciate
you
being on and it being able to tell you some of the things that happened in my musical listening life.
No, this is great. We love it, especially you know, getting first generation fans talking about the listening in real time. I mean, it's really a treat to hear, you know, people's thoughts and get their takes on, you know, these events that happen, you know, once a year, you know, as new albums come out.
When they came out. And that's the, you know, it's, you know, not too many people share that with us these days. So it was, I know somebody who can tell us about it because he lived it. So I was happy to have you on, and I'm glad you could come on. So I appreciate it, Dad.
Yeah. Thank you for having me.
Yeah. No problem. Well, go ahead, Andy.
So that's going to wrap it up for us. Tom, what do you have in the pipeline coming up for Talk More Talk?
Well, at this point, when this gets aired, I have no clue.
Right, because we're recording this a few weeks before this is going to drop. This episode's dropping actually the weekend that Beatlefest Chicago is happening, of which I'll be at. I'll see some of you all at Chicago at the fest. Come say hello. Kid O'Toole will be there, and Tom and I will be doing some live sessions as well on our channel.
Look
from the
to
fest.
That.
Yep. Radio Row style. For those of you who know what that means, I'll be there. So, that's when this episode's dropping. So we'll hope to see some people that weekend. Talk More Talk is rolling on. And, what else is in the pipeline for Two Legs, Tom?
Well, I'm sure we're going to have a couple more installments of Things We Bought Yesterday and Today. Posted by the time this episode is posted, and I'm sure we'll have by this time maybe have interviewed John Blaney, author of the songs he was singing series, and as well as artist Jeff Cummins, as we know as the artist that from so many works of so many different works of McCartney's, such as the Thrillington album, the inner gatefold of Wings Over America. You got the Say picture sleeve, this one picture sleeve, Temporary Secretary picture sleeve. So much work that he's done throughout McCartney's career. And we had to postpone an earlier recording with him, but he says that we're going to get it in soon. So hopefully by the time this is posted, we will have interviewed him as well. So yeah, a bunch of good stuff coming up
for the rest of the summer. Good to hear it. Thank you, partner. So for Tom, for my dad John, this is Andy from Two Legs signing off, and we'll see you next time. Thanks.
Peace and love.